Good afternoon. Welcome to the fifth and final session. We're going to be dealing with two topics, basically. First half is about mindfulness, and we have a guest speaker. Second half, I'll be dealing with this course and the exams. So I'm just going to set mindfulness in context for this course. So that graph shows, from a very psychology student point of view, how many hits you get in the PsycINFO database. So it's near zero from 1990, and it just began to show signs of taking off in the millennium. By 2011 it had gone up. I did an update there for the last 10 years or so, and as you can see, it's still accumulating. Mind you, this is probably very medically based hits, but there you go. First of all, I just want to say there's at least one view, is that there's two ways, from your perspective, I think, of looking at mindfulness. One is scientific and the other is poetic, or at least whatever you choose to contrast scientific with. And the scientific, of course, is about, if you force other people to do it, will it be good for them from the outside? The other is it good for you from the inside? These are three reviews, really, of showing a medical view of the benefits. But I just want to offer another contrast from a positive psychology view. Rowan will no doubt correct me if I say something too completely wrong. But in trying to relate it to other aspects in positive psychology, I'd say one view is about helping you control your attention so that you can actually perform the things you want to perform better. The other theme is about processing things that have happened to you so that they stop intruding and that you feel calmer in the long term. And so there are two kinds of themes there, really. And that second one about processing has been called by many different names, I think, in Western culture. Certainly it can be called meditation or contemplation. The famous translated quote attributed to Socrates about the unexamined life not being worthwhile certainly fits here. Though you might not have come across her, there's a nun, Sister Wendy Beckett, who in the past did a number of documentaries, mostly about art history. But one comment she let drop in a slightly more personal documentary made it clear that when she talked about herself praying, she wasn't, as I think, about greedy people importuning the deity for their own material advantage. She clearly seemed to be saying that for her, prayer and why she liked to spend so many hours a day in prayer was to do with some sort of internal contemplation, or as I might call it, reflection. So those are two aspects. So our speaker is going to be Rowan. Perhaps most famous for a meditation app. He's got a book out, published last month. Yes, I read several pages, and that's exactly what I thought. But also, the book is clearly aimed at something, I think, that if you only read the medical literature or the more experimental literature, Rowan's talking about how that kind of classical attitude is actually very off-putting to many would-be practitioners. That he suggests many ways of recasting that for a modern life. And that actually fits with informal practice, I pick up from talking to classes like this, where you read in the literature, if you go to the standard kind of course a university puts on for its students, will be workshops once a week for 8 weeks with homework as well, as if nothing less would do. But actually what most students do is when they're stressed, they go back to this mindfulness thing ad hoc in a way that would be deeply disapproved of by professional meditators. But the fact they go back to it seems to me to speak volumes about it must be useful to them in a very short term in a completely different kind of context. And Rowan's book is much more aligned with that real usage. And that's important if any of you go on, as it's quite possible you may, to provide, recommending and providing mindfulness, to think about the actual practice and the ways it might fit into life and not be stuck with a somewhat out of date but very professional way of doing it. Of course, Rowan's just started a new career as a father. but that photo must be several weeks old and the baby's probably twice as big already and almost certainly twice as loud as well. So, over to Rowan then.
Examples of some of the stuff we make. So Buddhify on the top right is our most popular product at the moment. It's done really well. It's like on the iOS version has been top of the health and fitness charts in over 42 countries so far. It's been out for just over 2 years and it's going to be popular. We have a new app coming out called Sleepfulness. Which is not a coincidence, given my new career as a father. interestingly, if you think about, I'll pick up the theme of this one later on, but in the way that Steve intimated, people use mindfulness increasingly for a very specific reason. So what we learned from Buddhify is if you look at the wheel, the wheel represents different parts of your day, and some of those parts of your day are, the top section is sort of the sleep there, and there's going to sleep, can't sleep, and waking up. And what we found on the data showed us was that this was by far the most popular part of the app by an order of magnitude. So we just sort of followed that insight and made the sleepless product sort of, because more people, the number of people who type into the App Store, type into Google, I want to meditate, is nothing compared to the number of people who I need to sleep, and why can't I sleep? So the outcome is more important than the process. So that's sort of a bit of a theme. The reason why people use mindfulness is much more than just wanting to be mindful. It's a very specific outcome. Because there's more to life than apps, we make physical things. We made a lovely product called Cards for Mindfulness as an experiment, which did well at Kickstarter last year, and just brought out a book, which is happening as well. So that's the kind of thing we're working on. We've got two new projects in development at the moment, one a partnership with a hospital in the States, and one another experiment for us as well. So, this is a bit of a medley of sort of various aspects. I thought I gave a talk here last year, and I covered some of the stuff in last book that I didn't use later, the sort of refreshed thinking, I guess. So what I'm going to cover is just to give you a sense of mindfulness is something that you certainly, and most people in general, pop culture, will have heard more and more of in the last few years. And just to really tell you a story of how that happened. So I think how that happened will actually really help us understand the limitations and the opportunities that mindfulness has today. So going back a bit so we can look forward. So that's the brief history. I'll talk about what I call the two problems, which is sort of the thesis of the book, really, which are the two sort of problems which are holding back conventional mindfulness as it is today. given that we are where we are, so I want to talk a little bit about mindfulness research, which has been going through a big boom, exponential boom in the last 8 to 10 years. And normally the normal story you hear is that it's all left on the disciple. I thought it might be interesting to represent some of the critical analysis actually of some of the mindfulness research. I'll talk a little bit about what I'm excited about the next 5 to 10 years of mindfulness and where it might go. And then I didn't do this last year's theme, but I thought I'd actually share some actual practices at least with the students. That we found that students have found really useful. So to finish up with some things that might actually help you in your work. And a bit of a warning, I don't have an academic background, so there may not be like, apologies if I'm not promoting for legal work from an academic and research perspective. I'm not a researcher, I'm a sort of a product designer, so my perspective is biased in that. I'm also incredibly opinionated on this area, as an area that I care a lot about personally, and also have now professionally become more and more involved in, obviously, and have quite a broad view of such an interesting view over the difference of the mindfulness industry as it is now, from the clinical to the very commercial. So I might express some quite strong opinions, and I have a thought. So what are we actually talking about? So I'm going to share two definitions, a general one and a specific one. So in the general one here, mindfulness and meditation are actually used interchangeably. And this is a bit of a this is actually a technical definition. I'm going to unpack it. So deliberately using your attention so as to develop positive qualities. So there's three aspects to this, unpacking that. One, it's all about attention, it's all about awareness. So it's all about being aware of what's happening in your experience on a moment-to-moment basis whilst it's happening. So that's the sort of the classic definition, the sort of the well-accepted definition of mindfulness, the sort of present moment awareness. So you're using your attention, and you're deliberately using your attention, and that deliberately bit is really important. So what that means is that you're using your attention in a particular way. So you're applying some kind of technique or practice. So that bit is important because from my perspective, so people, I often hear people say to me, oh yeah, listening to music is my meditation, or walking in nature is my mindfulness practice, or playing music, all these different sort of really lovely things which evoke the sort of relaxation response. But for me, that isn't a mindfulness practice because it doesn't have a technique, it doesn't have an intentional technique. Unless when one listens to music and you're deliberately deciding to place your mind in a particular way, for me, mindfulness meditation requires a technique. And the third aspect of this definition is doing that so as to develop positive quality. So why are you practicing this technique? So, for example, different people have different reasons. So you can practice mindfulness techniques for having better concentration when you're studying, or having better self-awareness of your mental habits, or having a more sense of connection with others when you're in a social situation. All these different positive qualities that you're developing, sort of capacities, I guess. So I think there's a danger at the moment within the sort of the common pop mindfulness conversation that there's this idea that we talk about being mindful. For me, being mindful doesn't actually have a great sense of meaning. I don't practice mindfulness to be mindful. I practice mindfulness to be calm, wise, and kind to others. That's my personal motivation. And so having a sense of the outcome, I think, is really important. So that's my sort of general definition of mindfulness. We'll sort of come back to that again. And the specific one is the one I've already mentioned. So the specific thing of mindfulness as a trait is knowing what is happening in my experience while it is happening. So right now, what's happening is I'm a little bit anxious. I can feel the physical sensations of my feet on the floor. I've got a sense of the space of the room. There's a moment of calm now. I'm now feeling embarrassed. So that's a real time account of my experience. And that's why I know mindfulness is present, in, because I'm aware of that happening in real time. So knowing what is happening whilst it is happening is my sort of preferred definition of the specific quality of mindfulness. So, that's the preamble. So how do we get to now? So, again, I think this is really instructive. I'm going to go back to this story again. It really helps me understand sort of what, how modern mindfulness got to where it is now. So, obviously mindfulness and meditation has a long history before the 1960s, but for the sake of this story, I think I'm going to start at this point where a generation of people, very similar age to you, to yourself, were very dissatisfied with what was happening in their home cultures, particularly in the US, sort of post-Vietnam War US, very disillusioned with the values of that culture, and likewise in Europe as well, and were very much attracted by the romance of the East, as advertised by George Harrison and people like that, right? So we had this very romantic idea of India and Asia and the spiritual traditions there, and the sort of hippie countercultural movement. There's literally a big, giant movement of people. It's really sad now that we can't travel this route, but there's a route, the hippie trail, which went from, you could have traveled from overland, effectively, from France all the way to India through Iraq, Afghanistan. It's a very well marked out route, which now is impossible, but a bunch of young people did that, and not all of those young people were there. Some were literally just along for the ride, and were trying to escape. But there were some people there who were genuinely looking for some answers in their sort of life. So let's call them sort of spiritual seekers, which is I guess the term for that. And those are those spiritual seekers who got really into yoga. The legacy of their influences the modern yoga movement now as we know it, and the legacy of those who got really into meditation is the mindfulness movement as we know now. And a bit of nerdy technical detail is that within India itself there wasn't historically a lot of mindfulness meditation practice, so you found that people who didn't quite get into it in India, went into countries like Burma, Sri Lanka, and Thailand, and started learning mindfulness-based meditation there, which was very much part of a certain part of the Buddhist tradition. So they were learning it within a Buddhist wrapper, but very much learning exclusively the meditation piece. And of the sort of hundreds, I guess, of young people that did that, some of those young people were really gifted. They were so gifted that their teachers essentially said, you understand this stuff so well, why don't you go back home and teach there? Teach what you've learned there. Because that's where you come from. Like, you couldn't stay here and whatever. So a lot of people did stay in Asia. But importantly, a small group of people, not more actually than maybe 15 to 20 people, who were really talented young meditators, just really got it and really got the impulse to share that. They went back to the UK and to the US in particular. And they set up very early sort of meditation communities in the mid-70s and late 70s, early 80s. And the reason that was probably the most important first moment in this story is because it was the first time in history that Western people were learning meditation from Western teachers in a Western place. And that is really important. So in the past there have been Zen teachers from Japan and Tibetan teachers come over to the States and to the UK and do classes or whatever. But it's very different when you're learning from something from someone who looks just like you to someone who looks like a bald guy in robes, right? If someone has your culture references, they speak like you, they drift like you, then you have a relationship to that. What they're sharing in a completely different way. So that was really critical. Then what in those early communities, it was very much a spiritual practice as was being taught. And what happened was interesting was that the people that were in those rooms, in those early classes and retreats and so on, they had day jobs. And some of them were therapists, some of them were molecular biologists, some of them were psychologists, some of them were medical doctors. And so they were learning this practice for their personal interest, and suddenly they were like, maybe what I'm learning here could be applied to this other area of my life that I understand so well, my clinical practice or my therapeutic or psychological practice. And it was that question in the mind of those early students that really then took on us onto the next movement. Because if you think about, in vague or broad, crude strokes, if the great wisdom tradition of the East is contemplative practice, meditation, mindfulness, then the great wisdom tradition of the West is science. And it's suddenly now, for the first time, again, all lots of new stuff happening. So we suddenly had a conversation, a dialogue between science, neuroscience, psychology, medicine, and meditation. And I think for those of you who have some understanding or some sort of background or know a little bit about mindfulness, the big bang of this meeting was a man called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was part of the very early communities, meditation communities in Boston, and happened to be at the University of Massachusetts, working actually as a molecular biologist, but then he saw how mindfulness could be applied to sufferers of chronic pain and people dealing with really difficult physical issues. And he basically badgered University of Massachusetts for a number of years and managed to start to get a little bit of research and interest in the clinical application of mindfulness. And then he's sort of become the godfather, I guess, of the modern mindfulness movement. And a lot of what is being taught, sort of the 8-week classes, the 6-week classes that you commonly find all around the world, very much come from his interpretation of mindfulness. And now, this also, as an aside, becomes the point where the word meditation gets dropped in sort of... because when you're, some of you, you may not be, probably not unfortunate enough to have to write very expensive sort of funding proposals at universities, but when you're trying to raise loads of money for a clinical trial, it's a lot easier to use the word mindfulness than meditation. Because back in those days, and still to this day, we have this sort of hangover around the word meditation and its association with the sort of hippie counterculture. But mindfulness had this cleaner, less baggagey tone to it. So mindfulness became the word that became sort of the forefront of this conversation now. And obviously, when you start using mindfulness in contexts like chronic pain and clinical context, you need data, right? It became no longer good enough to say, oh yeah, let's do it because these bored guys in Rome say it's great. That historically used to be enough. But now we need the data to back up the usage of it in a clinical context. And this is the moment when the data started piling up. And now, fast forward to today, mindfulness is used, I'll talk more in the research bit about mindfulness being used in all sorts of different contexts, medical contexts. And within the UK, it's now a nice recommended therapy for recurrent depression. Anxiety and depression is the most sort of common usage within the NHS for mindfulness, and also for things like chronic pain and chronic fatigue syndrome as well, the ones that are probably the most common. And then the interesting side effect of having loads of research data into mindfulness was that people who were previously very skeptical about it suddenly got interested. And in particular, big companies. So big sort of companies who, in the past, there had been mindfulness classes and programs in companies before, but typically they were led, but they only happened because of maverick leaders. So a maverick CEO happened to be a big meditator and basically forced his whole company to learn it. But now that there's loads of data showing that the effect of mindfulness on productivity, on stress reduction, that was all being generated through the sort of clinical research, the corporate world started sort of using that data to go, actually, maybe we can use this mindful stuff to help two things. One is employee well-being, and the second is productivity and focus. So different companies tend to be interested in mindfulness for different reasons, and those tend to be the two main ones. And I could list like a million companies that use mindfulness. That from the giant sort of like tech giants like Facebook and Google, all the way down to sort of small startups and law companies. And we get inquiries all the time. I probably get inquiries all the time. We don't make products for companies, but we get inquiries all the time from people that are interested in sort of mindfulness for employees. It's a really, really big growing market and interest. And I guess the fourth thing that really propelled mindfulness into pop culture was celebrity endorsement. So people just started, because suddenly like there's mindfulness and meditation became a thing that became okay to talk about. Suddenly people started outing themselves as long-term meditators. So anyone from usual suspects like Oprah and Gwyneth Paltrow to people maybe a bit more surprising like Arianna Huffington, Benedict Cumberbatch, all these sort of recently Will Young, the singer, all these different people talking about how they use mindfulness to help them in different aspects of their life. And then alongside that you have people like Mark Zuckerberg, Ed Williams at Twitter and Medium, like sort of big sort of tech sort of heavy hitters as well. And interestingly as well, we also have the use of meditation by sports teams. So I don't know if you know much about sports psychology, but the athletes basically use anything to get ahead. What, like that 1%, that 0.5% improvement will make all the difference between being sort of top of the league or second. And so high-profile teams, particularly in the States, so the Seattle Seahawks, who won the Super Bowl 2 years ago, Super Bowl 48, they have a very regular mindfulness program. And the most famous usage of mindfulness in sport is the Chicago Bulls and LA Lakers during the 90s. So even if you don't like basketball, but the Michael Jordan team, probably the greatest sort of basketball team of all time, were doing weekly meditation classes. Which is really fascinating. There's a really fascinating account of that. So they were like early adopters. And they were using it for a number of reasons. Maintaining flow state whilst playing, and maintaining the stress of being the lead athlete, and maintaining present moment awareness in high pressure situations. So all these really, really interesting use cases. And that instance of like really, really tough sports people, and particularly like male sports people using mindfulness, just totally breaks the previous image of it as a very sort of soft, feminine activity. Now we're seeing the full range of type of person being involved in it, and so it's really, really opened up. So that different type of use case has really changed how mindfulness is perceived. And this is one of the references I've included on the slide, but it's really interesting to look at this study. It's really and I guess a really important milestone. So in October, at the House of Parliament, there was a launch of a report called the Mindful Nation Report, over the previous 18 months, there was what's called an all-party parliamentary group looking at the potential for mindfulness in public life. And it looked at particular areas. It looked at healthcare, criminal justice, education, and the workplace. And it basically, groups of MPs would basically hear testimony from all different people who have been working in these areas, and it was all summarised, and it's actually a really excellent report, which is really worth looking at as a summary of definitely the public, sort of the public value of mindfulness in the UK in particular. And what was a nice corollary of that was that during that 18 months, 200 MPs and parliamentarians and Westminster staff went through mindfulness classes, which is really amazing. So I went to the launch event, and it was amazing because when you go to sort of an event like this, sometimes you go to the House of Parliament, whatever, but somewhere quite fancy, and actually the event can be quite minor, and the people there are not necessarily significant. But what I was really amazed by this mindfulness report launch was that there were three ministers there. Nicky Morgan, the Minister for Education, was there talking about mindfulness. And that was pretty significant, that there were three sort of major government ministers talking about their opinions on mindfulness. And one minister in particular, Tracy Crouch, who's Minister for Sport, spoke about very openly her own struggles with anxiety and depression and how mindfulness had helped her. So this whole conversation around public well-being and mental health is becoming much more important politically, and it's really encouraging, and that was a really big moment for mindfulness in general, I think, in pop culture. So that's sort of the brief history there. And I think the growth of mindfulness itself shouldn't be seen as part of that, isolated by itself. Like, think of the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin is, why is mindfulness becoming so popular? It's not. It's also the fact that life is getting harder. Like, stress isn't going away. Mental health issues aren't going away. They're increasing. The opportunity for mindfulness to help people is growing. But I wanted to talk about sort of two main sort of two of the sort of big themes of my book I kind of sort of introduce, which is that there's a real sadness I feel in the mindfulness world as it is now. So on one side, you see all the data, you hear all the good news stories, you see all the celebrities using it, you see all these interesting companies using it, you see all the people getting benefits. And so you go, okay, mindfulness is really great. But then the other messages are, to get the most out of mindfulness, you need to find the thing that you don't have, which is time, right? So if time is like the scarce resource of our culture, there's a bit of a paradox in the way that we're presenting mindfulness. So mindfulness is typically presented as something like you go to a class or course for 6 Wednesday nights in a row, learn it there, do it for 20 minutes each day, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes each day. People find it really hard to find that time. So despite all this interest in mindfulness, the vast majority of people who are interested in it don't do anything about it. And it's these two problems again and again. It's, I don't have time. And the second reason, which is people are always being told that the only way to be mindful with technology is to turn it all off. And so the second reason people don't accept it is that they say, well, actually, my life is already really digital and I can't afford to turn it off. So this is what I call the time problem and the digital problem. And I'll just explain how to solve those two problems. So mobile mindfulness is essentially the core idea of all the work that we do as a company, which is, in contrast to formal mindfulness. So formal mindfulness is sitting on a chair, taking 10-20 minutes in relative silence, doing a technique, and then once you finish that technique, going out and going into the rest of your life. That's how classes work, that's how courses work, that's how the majority of apps work as well. Now, the problem, like I said before, is that people find it really hard to find that time. And so the mobile mindfulness approach simply turns it on its head and says, instead of you having to find time to practice, why don't we bring the mindfulness to wherever you are? So if someone struggles to find 10 minutes to have some quiet time for themselves, they still have let's say they sleep for 8 hours, they still have 16 hours of the day in which they're able to practice meditation. Because remember the definition. The definition is using a technique, using your attention to improve a positive quality. So those three things do not require you to be in any particular place. So if you're in a lecture hall, or if you're walking between engagements, or if you're on the train home, if you know the right technique, you can meditate. So mobile mindfulness is exactly that, which is presenting techniques which can be applied to everywhere you are and whatever you're doing. And that solves the time problem. And I'm not advocating throwing away formal meditation at all. Formal meditation is incredibly important. But what I'm saying is that the best for people who find it really hard to find time to do formal meditation, the best way in is this mobile approach, and then you can back that up with formal practice to deepen the effects and the learning. And the second problem was that technology problem. So these six books, sort of, again, they're in the notes and whatever, but they indicate sort of the popular narrative we have around technology in our culture with regard to the mind, which is technology is ruining our minds. We're still the shorthand for a lot of the... So The Shadows is a very important book about 7 years ago by Nicholas Carr, who argues that the way that we are consuming information is ruining our attention span, ruining concentration and all this kind of stuff. And particularly, if one of those books, maybe the best one to read is Mind Change, Susan Greenfield's book, where she presents a lot of different research into pop technology and the effect on the mind. And she attempts to do it in quite a balanced way, but she clearly has a very particular agenda. But it's definitely like an interesting book to review, and I think the other ones are interesting as well. Slightly different is Azari's book, looking at how technology is changing our relationship to relationships. And perhaps my favourite book of all of them, it's very technical, is Addiction by Design by Natasha Dow-Schull, which is a study of how gambling machines work in Las Vegas. She breaks down the mechanics of how these sort of one-armed, when you see like these old sort of old people sort of sitting in their thousands, like watching, like just pulling their one-armed bandit and all this, and she basically breaks down how the whole process is created, because the reason how those machines work is important because a lot of our modern software is designed using addictive techniques learned through gambling. So Candy Crush, your inbox client, Twitter, Instagram, they deliberately use techniques from machine gambling to make you addicted to the product. So that's a really good technical thought. But this is the overriding narrative, I would say. And so the result of that is naturally this thing that, well, in which case, the only way to be mindful and to deal with it all is to throw it away, to turn it off, to go on a digital detox, to turn off our phones every weekend, to throw them in the river, if you're feeling particularly brave. And that is one strategy. That's what I call the retreat move. But the problem with that strategy is that two things. One is that technology underpins our lifestyle. It's increasingly underpinning our lifestyles, our economy, our sort of social fabric. And so if our only solution to deal with it is to throw it all away, then we're in a bit of a problem. And the second problem is that we're in danger of pathologizing our devices. Even the term digital detox implies that our technology is toxic, which is a really, really bad place to be, because that is basically going to lead to a car crash for us in society, where if we're constantly relating to our devices as being inherently evil. And so the alternative is to actually, instead of how do we actually change our relationship to our devices to be more mind positive, to be more supportive of our well-being. And again, those are techniques you can do through the lens of mindfulness. And I'll share some of them at the end. Part three. Steve gave some really good graphs before. This is a very similar graph. This is the graph of papers published on mindfulness by year 1980 to 2030. And it's a couple of years out of date, but I actually know that, so the big number is 549 in 2013, but I actually know that in 2015 there were 1,200. So that curve has continued. And so we've seen this boom, right? There's a boom in mindfulness research. And it's been applied all over the place with regards to the clinical therapeutic map. And what we typically find is that what's being tested is the what's called the mindfulness-based stress reduction or mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy models of treatment is being applied in these all these different contexts. And it's like, you can imagine some kind of condition and you can find a mindfulness-based approach. But what I wanted to do, just to give a bit of balance, and again, I'm not a researcher, but just sort of just show you a bit of the, because there has been some criticism for mindfulness research, and it isn't always talked about. So I just wanted to sort of, and I can again, I can point you to the criticism of it. But I think just give some examples of what the kind of things that come up. The first thing is actually that the warning mindfulness isn't always the same thing in each research, in each report. Some of the things are very, very different, are technically very different. And so that is clearly a big issue. So for example, if there's a research report, and it becomes even worse, say there's a research report on mindfulness in ADHD, and then someone comes along and makes a, say someone then comes and makes a product, commercial product that says, based on this research, I'm making a mindfulness product that helps children with ADHD. And what you might find is that the mindfulness being taught in the product is nothing like the mindfulness in the research. And that is a big problem. Often there's a big range of difference between quality of instructor and researcher across all the studies. There are very, very few random controlled trials. But there are increasingly more, which is the good news. The self-report scale has some flaws to them. Blobology is my favourite sort of term, one of my favourite terms, which is this thing where people just put up fMRI scans of the brain and say, oh, this red bit shows that this mindfulness is lighting up this part of the brain, therefore X, Y, and Z. Even within like neuroscience, when you speak to sort of some neuroscience, they say, well, we don't even understand what this sort of lighting up aspects of this sort of data means. And so making very clear causal assertions about that is very problematic. Hours of meditation is not a good proxy for expertise. So someone can sit meditation for 10,000 hours, or 100 hours, and maybe be doing it wrong, or be doing it in a limited way, and not necessarily have the level of expertise. So a meditator taught well, who practices for 100 hours versus a meditator who isn't taught well, or just sort of fumbles by themselves for that same 100 hours, can be in completely different levels of understanding. So hard to compare the two. The dark night effect is a little bit more involved, which means a lot of meditation techniques originally in the spiritual context were designed to look at individual aspects of our life. Because a lot of when you get into the deeper end of mindfulness practice, you're doing a bit of an archaeology of your psyche, really, of your mental habits and patterns, and not all of the stuff you see there is necessarily great. And so you can have some effects where there's a danger of if you put people who are in vulnerable mental states through practices which result in you looking at your mental patterns in a deep way, that can cause some problems, and that's called the dark night. So in the classic Buddhist meditation world, certain practices are designed on purpose to make you go through difficult experiences. By seeing difficult experiences, you're able to sort of deal with it and thrive through and come out the other end. But if you give that same experience someone who's borderline psychotic or has bipolar condition, then you get a lot of trouble. And there have been instances of that kind of thing happening. So that's obviously a concern. And the last one is probably my main criticism, which is whenever mindfulness is being applied in a different context, it's always the same kind of fact. It's always that 8-week course, the 6-week course, being applied to conditions A, B, C, D, E, F, G. There's actually very little, innovation with regard. Oh, okay. So this. So for example, ADHD is a great example, right? So the core problem someone has with ADHD is that they can't sit still and concentrate, but they're given practices which require them to sit still and concentrate, because that's the MBSR model. And so people with ADHD have real trouble with that. And then the results tend to be a bit all over the map, and you wonder why that is. But if you design a practice which is more suited to someone with an ADHD type condition, then maybe they might have better effects. So currently too much of the research, in my opinion, just uses like a cookie cutter mindfulness approach. No, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to rattle through. But there are, the good news really is that despite the boom, we're still in relatively early stages. So there's some new meta reviews, so Steve pointed to three really great meta reviews. There's some new meta reviews coming out that sort of catch up the high end of that boom, taking up the moment. If you're interested in this mindfulness work, we're lucky in the UK, there are two centres who really specialise in that. Bangor University and Oxford Mindfulness Centre are really excellent, doing some of the best research in the world at the moment. Definitely worth a look. There's an amazing project being done by the Wellcome Trust, which is a 7-year longitudinal piece of research into the application of mindfulness in schools. It's a completely groundbreaking piece of work, and will be one of the most robust pieces of evidence ever created, especially for youth. Definitely for mindfulness, but for young people as well, to really see the effect. The difference between a pre and post study versus a 7-year longitudinal effect in children or students. And the all-party parliamentary group, the information report, the thing that I shared, has a number of recommendations which are leading to more research as well. So that's some good news for that. So, I might skip this bit. I might go off the topic. So this is me just sort of talking about what I think is coming next for mindfulness. So currently, when you experience mindfulness, or when you're learning mindfulness, there are a series of sort of classic mechanisms you'll do to learn that. So you do face-to-face classes, so MBSR, MBCT are the sort of classic courses. You might go to a different type of meditation class as well, which is still very popular. You might explore meditation through books. The most popular one by a mile, being called Mindfulness in a Frantic World by Dr. Mark Williams from the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, which is the modern classic in its field. You get online courses which are really well done, such as Be Mindful, which is hosted by the Mental Health Foundation. And then you get sort of consumer apps such as the one that I make as well, and Headspace is probably the most popular. Well, it's the most popular one at the moment. So that's sort of the marketplace, the world of mindfulness that it is right now. And what I see sort of happening in the next 5 to 10 years is that because going to a mindfulness class is already, there already aren't enough mindfulness classes, face-to-face mindfulness classes to serve demand. As the NHS becomes more and more willing to refer people to mindfulness classes to deal with condition X, Y, and Z, there's basically a supply failure of the ability for teachers to exist. So places like Bangor and Oxford are churning out qualified teachers, but they can't keep up with the demand of it. And so we need some kind of delivery model basically where online and apps, sort of digitally delivered products, have the same sort of esteem within the mindfulness world as the classes. Currently, people there's a bit of an irony in that products like Buddhify and Headspace are loved by the people that use them, by the general population, but within the sort of more conservative part of the mindfulness community who are very research-led, because our digital products haven't had the time or funding to do go through all the research hurdles, we find that we're often sort of seen as second-class citizens, despite the fact that we have a lot of benefits for our users and we have a large sort of portion of that. So what we're going to find is that researchers are increasing, included more and more into products like ours, so that we have more validation in certain circles to do that. And that will lead to maybe more innovation, which is what we need to get to next step. And the final thing is our transformative technology, probably the trend that I'm most excited about, which is hardware. So we're seeing a generation of companies, mainly based in the States, who are creating technologies based around EEG, based around galvanic skin response, to basically help sort of can you train mindfulness using hardware and technology in a way that's much more immersive than just listening to a bit of guided audio. And that's sort of a theme that is really emerging within sort of the startup world. And generally, I think the really exciting thing is that this whole area of mental well-being, let's call it mental well-being, is becoming more and more acceptable as a conversation in the workplace, around the dinner table. So the less stigma there is around mental health and mental well-being, the better, and I hope that mindfulness is playing a part in that. So we've only got 4 minutes left. So I'm going to not talk about that, and I'm going to just finish with like four or five practices that I think from the book that I think might be useful. So they pick up some of the themes. These are all mobile mindfulness practices, so things that you can do all during the day whenever you want them. So this is one of the technology related ones. So this is called mindfulness protocols. And those of you who've done some mindfulness will know that the most basic technique you ever learn is body awareness. So being aware of the breathing, being aware of sort of physical sensations is sort of like mindfulness 101. And I don't know if you're like me, but this is now sort of part of my body. I spend so much of my time in this posture that it may effectively be part of me. So how about we take that idea and include this device as part of our body? What does that mean from my perspective? It means that whenever you use the phone, you can be aware of the physical experience of using the phone. So I'm just checking my email, logging onto Twitter, looking at this and that. But at the same time, I'm aware of the physical sensations of the case, the smoothness of the screen and the scroll. Just these little things that train us in a greater sense of body awareness, the texture of the button, whilst I touch it, whilst I put the volume up. What that means is that in that moment I'm that little bit less sucked into the content, a little bit less sucked into the screen, and have a bit more sense of overall awareness. And when you do that, every act can become a mindfulness act. And that's the magic of this sort of simple practice. So a lot of these practices are sound very simple, but when you do them over time, they can be really quite extraordinary. This is a really important one that I do all the time, and something you'll know very well, which is the sort of relationship between the mind and body and how the strange connection, how when you're feeling emotionally stressed, different parts of your body will be tense, and sort of vice versa. And this dual relationship between tension in the body and tension in the mind is a really important, powerful tool. So this technique is called stress signature. All it means is that when you're feeling stressed, take the time to notice three or four parts of your body that are really flared up. So for me, when I'm feeling stressed, I tend to, my jaw tenses up, my hands get a little bit balled up. So those are my sort of two things. And when you have that, that's what I call my stress signature. And when if during the day, I'll just check those two parts of my body. I go, okay, how are my hands doing? How's my jaw? Is my jaw tense? And if they are, I'll just relax them. Or I'll just relax them just whenever I think about it. And when you do that, the benefit of doing that is that you might not be aware that you're getting stressed, but your body is getting stressed, so your hands are getting tense, and your face is getting tight. but using that information to okay, maybe there's a bit of tension there because they're really relaxing it, means that you can diffuse a sort of a stress letter that might have explode and spin out later on. So it's like an early warning signal for a stress attack or something like that, which is really useful, I find. Yeah, I think this is one I learned when I found that I was never listening to my wife when we first started dating. Obviously I changed because, you know, I'm a baby, being kicked out. But what I found myself was that I was in a conversation with her and I would just check out, right? I would just completely disassociate and just start thinking about something else or go and check my phone. I just actually was not listening to her. And the great thing about that is that you find it out quite quickly. So you find out that, like, 10 minutes later you're sleeping on the sofa, and like, so the feedback is quite clear that you're something that you can look at. And so real listening is probably the most generous thing one of the most generous things you can do in a relationship, whether that's just a friend or a romantic partner or a family member or whoever, a lecturer. And what it means is three types of listening, and it's not that you'll be familiar with, but it's worth doing. The first is listening, just actually just listening to the words. So that's how the obvious bit of listening. The second bit of listening is listening to how someone's saying it. So if my colleague Emmy is over there and is coming to work and I say, oh, how are you doing, Emmy? And Emmy goes, oh, I'm doing great, but actually I can see that her body's really tense or tight, or that she's actually not really smiling. That's me listening to how she's saying it, and that gives me more information to actually, maybe I can ask a question or just notice that she's actually, like, maybe something's happening. And then the third bit is the listening to yourself. So whilst the other person is talking, are you able to be aware of what's going on in your head at the same time? Because what I find is that I'm often just waiting for the other person to shut up so I can say what I want to say. So I think I'm in a conversation, but actually I'm just in a monologue and another person having a monologue, and we just haven't been in the same space. So being aware of the sort of very strange, like, I wish you would just shut up because I want to do this, I want to say this, and this thing happened to me last week and I really need to know about it. Being aware of the sort of, like, barrier to this connection between me and the other person is what I think makes really great listening. And the final two is inbox addicts. So whether for me I'm addicted to email, other people it's Instagram, other people it's Twitter, other people it's whatever it is. And what I found was that, like, I would, without even being aware of it, I would suddenly be scrolling through. I'd be writing my document, maybe doing some studying or reading an article or writing, designing a product, whatever it was, writing a book, and all of a sudden I'd be in my email or on Twitter, without being aware of it. And this practice is very simply, how aware can you be of that? How aware can you be of the process of you leaving the thing you want to do and going to your distraction? So sometimes you might just notice it while you're actually, I'm checking my email. Sometimes you might notice it just as a hand moving to check your phone. Oh, I'm checking my phone. Sometimes you might just feel it as an impulse. So like in the morning when I get up and I'll be like, impulse, I'll just see if that email helped. That makes a very subtle impulse. And then when you do this over time and your awareness is really good, you might actually just notice, this is where the real magic happens, is when you notice the feeling in the mind before the impulse happens. And what I find, you're interested to see what you find, which is when I'm doing some work and I get distracted, it's because I'm feeling lonely, or I'm feeling a little bit sad, or I'm feeling bored. And then this whole movement to check my phone, or to do whatever it is, to do the distraction, is me trying to make myself feel better. But if you're able to be aware enough to notice the feeling of sadness or boredom, then you can just watch it happen, and just let it go. And then that's incredibly liberating, and it can lead to a lot of concentration. And finally, if none of that works, you can always use Hello Monsters. So this is for when you're having a very difficult experience. So it can be anything from a something very like personal, like grief or upset or something more sort of something else like frustration or stress, whatever it is, whatever your flavour of monster is, it doesn't matter. And all you do is that you you take the difficult emotion that you're feeling and discuss that in your mind. Just take the difficult emotion that you're feeling and you give it a name. And you say hello. So for me, while I was writing the book, the monsters that came up again and again were doubt and restlessness. So doubt that the book would be any good, that anyone would read it, and restlessness that I was just, my mind was all over the place. So whenever I noticed that, I would go, hey restlessness, how are you doing? Hey doubt, good to see you again. Haven't seen you for at least 3 days. And what's happening here is a few things are happening. So this is just worth saying. One, the first thing is that I'm naming my emotion. So from a mindless perspective, that's important because I'm taking something that I'm identified with. I am frustrated, I am restless, and I'm saying there is frustration, there is restlessness. And that change from a subjective identification to an objective observation is the whole part of the mindfulness practice. And when you do that, you're able to move something you're very tightly identified with and observe it externally, that is freedom from a mindfulness perspective. And then the second part of saying hello to it is making friends with it. Because these difficult emotions don't go away. I don't know if you've noticed that. And so you might as well make friends with them, because otherwise you'll be in constant conflict. A lot of people spend a lot of their time fighting their emotions. So, oh, I'm so restless, like, there's restlessness. So you can still be mindful of restlessness and go, oh, there's restlessness. And then, but then on top, if you're not friendly with that restlessness, you go, oh, I'm so used to it. I'm restless again. I can't believe it. Well, I'm such a restless person. I'm such a waste of time. I'm so used to it. Because then you're fighting that restlessness. But if you're able to like, have a bit of humour around it, a bit of lightness, and go, hey, restlessness, hey, doubt, hey, anxiety, good to see you again. Like, just your whole relationship to it. And become enlightened, which for me is the whole point of life. So it's been a bit of a rattle, whistle stop tour through a million things. I hope that's been interesting. Do please get in touch if you're interested in any stuff that we do. The slides are now online on that URL. And the back of the slide is a list of references and stuff that I mentioned here. That would be interesting.
Questions?
So we need better perception of the state and solutions from that.
And there's also a secondary issue, which is a lot of the people who people are skeptical about teachability. And some of the reasons that sometimes they're right to be, and sometimes they're just skeptical because they're not actively digital. Something I should have mentioned before, which is the reason that technology is perceived as being anti-migrant by young people is because that generation of teachers who brought migrants to the West, who are all of whom are my heroes, and some of them are my direct teachers, their downfall is that they don't have strong digital lives themselves. So you can only teach what you know. So if you are a baby boomer, ex-hippie, meditation legend, then your class isn't going to be talking about mindfulness with your iPhone, how to be mindful with your email. They're not going to talk about it. They're going to just throw it in the river, which is what a lot of them say. And that sort of causes problems. So there's a generational issue. The people who are commissioning services need more education as to the validity of digital services.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Ryan.
Yes.
So, I'm basically going to move on to wrapping up this course. Dare say, not worth your while saying no, it's fine.
Can you just mention that, because a member of this class was an intern, can I just mention that?
Just before I go, just to say, last year, when I did the talk last year, last year we had and one of the members of this class joined us for attending, and she was a researcher on the book and a researcher on the NUS, which was great. So if you're interested in this stuff at all, we won't have many slots, but do just email me, and we can talk about it. So then you can put your name on the list. Michelle Pickford.
In other words, what you have to take from that is I might not know much, but I do know people who are worth knowing. Right. So, as well as wrapping up this course in several different ways, I'd like to start getting a bit of feedback from you. So, this is what I hope to fit in. So, perhaps you could just spend a minute now, get a blank sheet of paper. Sketch out your current thoughts on what was best and worst about this course, at least from where you're sitting at this moment, and then put that aside and we'll discuss it a little further in a moment. Just too digital for this course, aren't you? No paper, no pen. Okay, keep that on one side for the moment. So I'm just going to review the learning objectives, the wider learning objectives I had around organising the coursework in the way I have. So it's partly about covering a wide, the class collectively covers a wide range of topics that there'll never be time for me to talk about. That it should give you the experience of producing something of actual value to your peers. Because, of course, the trouble with organised education is almost always you're producing essays nobody has any real need for. It's different producing something that's actually intended to be useful and is useful. Also makes you, or at least is intended to encourage you to value the work of your peers. There's research on that if any of you are coming to my education module next week. You'll be hearing a lot about that. Of course, also there's, perhaps this is less true now, but there's certainly in the recent past there's been students who valued the group work done in level 3 and then felt bereft in level 4 when there was less. More experience of the joys and pains of division of labour, which is something many jobs will be experiencing, many jobs having to work with other people. Another point here though is about learning by teaching, because one of the things I think students least understand is that probably the single most important technique for improving your own academic learning, which you aren't already doing, is attempting to teach someone else. There have been many studies of that, and it's usually not bad for the recipient, but there's no doubt at all about the benefit for the person trying to do the teaching. In fact, even if I'm trying to write a paper I'm serious about, there comes a point when trying to explain it to someone else is a huge help in helping me organise my thoughts. I was hoping you'd to learn a different kind of writing, might come in future, different from normal academic writing, and also to some extent a technological experience, because using Google Docs, sharing it with a team in that way is becoming quite a common way for people to organise bits of collaborative work, nothing to do with universities. Right, so one of my aims was to get you to pay attention to each other's work, so I'm just going to devote a little time, a little time to hearing from the those groups that are present, Internet Explorer. Right, so we're going to spin the wheel, and the lucky group will have to speak for up to 60 seconds on why their topic's interesting. I see you're just as childish as I am. Right, anyone from group 18? On your feet, promote the topic for 30 to 60 seconds. What's it about? Is it interesting? Why? That's very good. Would you recommend it? You got interested?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really insightful to think about what your network is like and whether that applies to you or not.
Thank you very much. Anyone from group 17? Or so you say. Number 11. Stand up, project your voice. Tell us whether your topic should be ignored or... And so is this just a theory or is there some data that supports that? Thank you very much. Number 6. You being shy? Or nobody for number? Yep. So more novel than with overwhelming evidence so far, is that right? Okay, thank you. Number 4, yes? So you think it's an upside down U?
I think it's a normal distribution curve. So it means not that it's...
Your best.
I think we're all right in here.
Because there's no one clever in here, right, yeah.
You're all right, don't worry.
Yes. Well, certainly in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Marvin the robot is perpetually gloomy on the count of being more intelligent than any of the people who are ordering him around. Number 7.
Thank you.
So you enjoyed it. Right. And you recommend it as the best topic to study even for the exams here. Yeah? There you go. There you go. That's a useful kind of recommendation. Both fun and valuable. Right. So, I did that not only for a change of pace, but to give you an idea about how actually it can be very interesting to look at other people's pages. So, one or two practical issues. So, in 7 days and 6 hours or whatever it is, if the software works, the Moodle page will effectively freeze, so you can hardly see anything, and it might take me about a day to reset it for you, and that's effectively the deadline. After that, it will open up again, so that you can use each other's work for revision. You're welcome to submit further edits. You probably won't, because you'll have other things to work on, but if you do, I'll post them for you, but you'll no longer be able to update it yourself. Could I just ask for the people here, would you be okay if after the end of the course I open up this page to a wider public? That okay? Thank you. There's one more requirement that I'd like you to tell me by posting in your group's forum something about your division of labour. So groups who are entirely welded into one might just post a single message. Those who not having an entirely easy time in the group, perhaps you could just express, well, first of all, whether someone who's still notionally in your group actually has never been around, and I have to take into account you only had two active members, or if you didn't really feel there was an equal division of labour, perhaps you could just say what it is. Finally, this is a new thing I've just realised this morning that I'd like you to do. I think uploading the PDF version works best for readers, because a single click and up it comes. But I think it would be useful for me in the future if you also put a Word version up there, because occasionally I find myself editing broken links and things so as to make the page more useful in future. I think the easiest way to do that is you can, as you probably grasped, you can upload multiple versions. And if you upload both the Word and the PDF, but just select PDF and make that the main one, then I'll have access to an editable version, but the PDF will be there for instant use. I suggested these kind of elements might be represented in an ideal document. I realised that I didn't make explicit before, so there in blue, of course, is in one sense the really important thing, which you might well have automatically expressed, but just to draw your attention to it, that for most readers reading your page, what they most want to know is it going to interest them? And so, and they'll want to know it early on, because if they're not interested, they'd like to stop reading it pretty quickly. So it's a bit like being a restaurant or a film critic in a newspaper. In one sense, you're giving personal judgments, but in another, you're trying to be useful to a wider readership. So if you make sure you express why this topic is or isn't a good one to look at, then people will be able to apply their own personal criteria to that. So we heard that from a few of the people giving one-minute versions, different reasons why it might be interesting. It might be novel, might be well-established with a pile of evidence, might be medical. There are different reasons applied to different people. So expressing that early on in a brief form about what you think the attractions or lack of attractions in an area, in your area, are, that's really useful to readers. Does anyone... No, that's fine. No, it isn't. It's not that I'm expecting to see those headings, but they're a reminder about what people will probably find useful. And you have to make sure they find it, which is why you might choose to use headings for some of them. Well, that's a guide, yes. But very often it's obvious to me, this is well written, but I had to read four pages before I really could decide. That's not very good for this point of view. Although it's better than having only one page and not having the information everybody wants. So these are really prompts about the kind of things people often find, readers find valuable. Particularly, I think, the single best starter reference. Because for people who are a bit interested but still unsure, they might look at that and nothing else. And so that being good as a first thing to read, that I think most people find that really useful for those who are a bit interested but undecided. So apart from the one in blue, that's all in the handout. Are there any more questions? One student in the class emailed me saying they wished I would show them, pick out an A grade wiki from a previous year. I think a really keen team will make sure they get people who give them feedback, and if it's not in actual written form as I've tried to promote in the reciprocal exercise, you could get a friend from another group just to sit and to read it while you're present and get them to think aloud while they're reading it and give you feedback on the spot. I think the ideal version of that is if one way or another you find someone who is never going to be interested in your topic and someone who's very keen, because the ideal page should serve both of those well. So if you only go with people who are predisposed to like the topic, that only gives you how to write a page for someone who's going to follow it up like crazy. The other part is it going to be good for people who aren't going to follow it up but would like, you know, a 2-minute version of what that's about. So those are different kinds of participants to think about and get to test. And as I say, if the people who've actually written up a critique have answered those questions, then that's good. But it can be it can feel cheaper to the participant if they just have to think aloud while they're reading it. And for that, you just have to kidnap them for a few minutes and get them, as I say, to think aloud while they read through your page. Pick up from their reactions So whether or not they complain is less important than whether you can tell from what they say that they've missed something you really thought they ought to have picked up, or on the contrary are well able to find what they want quickly. Okay, so as I have mentioned before, I tend to think about positive psychology not just in terms of topics like burden of choice or mindfulness, but in terms of themes which can be useful ways of comparing and contrasting different topics. And on the whole, a lot of exam questions are attempting to suggest a theme and ask you to comment on it with topics you yourself have made a choice of. So one kind of theme is about the attributions that people make, or if you like, the meanings they project, and that involves ideas of balancing and so on. A different theme is about happiness or satisfaction or well-being. It's about the different kinds of ways people... I mean, those differences in words, of course, reflect somewhat different attempts to get at this, but there's one theme there, and you might want to pay particular attention to it, not from the point of view of exam, but if you ever have course to say you're applying for a job, you say you've been to a positive psychology course, probably one of the best ways to show that you aren't just a naive enthusiast but have some sort of understanding in the area would be to be able to say something about the nature of well-being, the different ideas, and perhaps your view on the best definition, which might involve those, as I said. Third example of a theme, although I don't have a single good name for it exactly, is there seems to be a potential for thinking about flow, the strength approach, burden of choice, simplifying your life as all somehow related to the fact that having less choice rather than more can in fact be what we enjoy under quite a few circumstances, as opposed to a naive consumer society idea that the more choice the better. Here's an attempt at listing themes. That's certainly not probably an exhaustive list. These slides are already up on the page, on the course webpage. So if I have second thoughts tonight, I might edit them a bit. So I mentioned that sort of theme around attributions and interpretation of meanings, theme around the nature of happiness, theme around decisions and choice. D, rebranding, that's because some people, like Margaret Martin, for instance, thinks positive psychology as a field is a lot of nonsense. It's just rebranding various bits of perfectly good psychology. And it's certainly always interesting to be able to discuss any piece of positive psychology in terms of what was pre-existing, probably with a different label before. And it's notable that although there are now at least four journals for positive psychology, that many of the biggest papers are published in quite different journals. So in any case, many of the papers written aren't necessarily pushing the positive psychology as their main way of presenting what they're interested in. Theme E, you'll be familiar with, is about strength or weakness or the absence of evidence. And I thought Rowan's comments were very interesting about that in with respect to mindfulness too. So although in one sense more evidence looks impressive academically, in mindfulness and maybe in some other areas, you have to balance that against whether the best research areas are somehow out of date and not tackling new problems, and or at least not tackling the context which will be most important for rolling them out as an application. So those are the kind of issues you might discuss under evidence. F is connections with past religions and cultural practices. When available, always interesting to remember them. G is about whether they're self-help exercises or not, and topics vary a lot depending on whether that's at the heart of the topic or almost absent. H, I think, isn't discussed enough, and Rowan didn't actually discuss that explicitly today for mindfulness, but one of the eye-openers for me in the talk he gave last year was the idea that meditation or mindfulness practices can be social, they can be designed for two people to bounce something between them. And that to me was completely different from the naive image I had. But actually it's a good question for a lot of positive psychology, because of the roots of a lot of positive psychology in a self-help movement, that tends to bias the way topics have developed as being largely around solitary self-help practices. But as I certainly mentioned at some length with gratitude, for instance, there can be social interactional versions. So it's quite a good theme to think about in connection with every bit of positive psychology, about whether you can identify the solo and also separately identify a social version of this issue. I'm not saying it would always apply, but it's a good thought exercise. Skip IJ is about whether it's good to go with your strengths, really. The question is this a general theme that you could ask of a number of areas of positive psychology that are focusing on strength, and whether or not that's a good thing to do. So, the kind of exam questions on this course, whether or not the question is explicit about the thing at the top, unless it says something definitely different, you should be assuming that I'm expecting you to take two or more topics and discuss the issue in the question and illustrate both sides of it. That is, things that do fit and things that really don't fit any assertional theme. So when I say topics, I mean things like mindfulness, good drives out bad, so on. When I talk about themes, I've just been through those. So a common exam question type, as you'll see if you look at past papers, is really about a theme. You can ask a question around any theme. However, there are some other general questions that aren't necessarily exactly themes, like what's the best or worst supported thing you've ever come across in positive psychology. In some years of the course, the wiki topics have been like topics, and a few of them they were more like themes. I'd say this year's wiki topics, subjects are topics, but they're often relatively novel rather than traditional ones. So, I was just repeating stuff that's already there in that document. So, I think my revision advice is to pick a small number of topics that you learn relatively well, and you want to pick them, therefore, for contrasting properties, so that they're good contrasts with respect to as many themes as you can fit in. Because then whatever original question I manage to think of, you've got a good chance of having examples you can turn to in tackling the question. So, I'm going to go through at least one or two exam questions. If I manage to stick to my agenda, I'll first show the question, give you a minute to decide what you think the theme is, and then we'll show it, maybe have a bit of general discussion. So number one is, to what extent is positive psychology just at a relabeling of ancient religious and cultural practices? So have a moment, decide what theme you think it is. I generally probably say that. Questions really about two things: consciousness on the one hand and reinterpreting meaning of events on another. Third one I've got here is as follows. Take this a bit more slowly. So, first of all, you all decided that you know what theme it is. I think it's about rebranding. The question could have been reworded and yet have essentially the same meaning. Could have had a quote say for positive psychology as nothing new. Perhaps you'd like to take a moment and out of the topics you've come across so far, which you might pick if you were writing an answer to that question. Anyone care to suggest an outline? Might be two good contrasting topics with respect to this issue of there's nothing new. Oh yes, there is. Stretching way back.
Yeah.
Right. So that would be an example of something with a long history that could be happily categorised outside. What would you use for one that couldn't be? Anyone? Maybe that question doesn't exactly ask that, does it? It asks you to dig at the topic and say what some aspects that do and don't fit within it. Sorry, so reading my own exam question properly, more carefully, as is always wise. So how would you say that for your topic of the dark side? Right, you're thinking of Fredrickson's work on... Okay. Anyone got a different approach? Okie dokie. Best and worst established areas of positive psychology. So first of all, what's the theme? This theme is evidence strength, absolutely classic. So, what topics would you recommend as heavily evidenced, and what's the flakiest topic you've come across yet? So for heavily evidenced, what would you suggest? Yeah, taken up by the medics and done that, so that's hard hitting in that area. So what topics have you come across that have little or no quality evidence? Okay, so moderately plausible theory, but no weighty evidence.
And it's definitely being used by more and more people, and more people are watching things like blogs and following blogs. So it makes sense that people would be studying this behavior, but they're just doing content analysis. They're not actually looking at bloggers themselves and what they find as a result of doing these sort of personal reflections.
Okay, good example. Any other example of a positive psychology area that's pretty weak? Yep. Yes. On the one hand, I might try and argue that that's about technology, not positive psychology. On the other hand, actually, it's certainly mHealth, if you are going to count that as definitely in, but also it's probably important for quite a lot of delivery-related things, yes. In other words, it'll be important for applications of various areas in positive psychology, and you're saying generally the evidence is lagging behind the techno-enthusiasm. What would you say the theme might be for this? Actually, I don't think it is a theme, it's just going to be a classical... it wasn't one of the themes I pointed out especially, but wouldn't give you any trouble in the exam. However, it could be that a more interesting answer to that question would be to emphasize the things that clinicians have adopted when it was never in any clinical repertoire before. After all, the question is about what have clinical approaches got to learn from. So it might be more interesting to answer the question like that. So mindfulness would be a huge one. Could think about whether exercise is another, that is, exercise's effects on mental states as opposed to physical states, which is where the medical lot first focus. I'll just skip ahead to so I suppose I'm clearly thinking in that question about people who don't like positive psychology. So if you were trying to argue with someone like that, what example would you choose? So that doesn't probably have quite a classical theme, but evidence strength might be the first of the themes that you'd recruit. But it could be that novelty or something else would be more about impressing people. I thought one aspect of Rowan's talk today that's quite interesting was how different kinds of promotion of mindfulness have had different effects. So scientific data was one, but celebrity adoption is another, or big company adoption is a different kind of being impressive. I just, as a last example, wanted to comment on this. I probably wouldn't normally ask a question. The trouble with this question is it mentions three topics, so it's not very likely that a student would feel they knew a lot about just the three I happened to mention. So I wouldn't say this is a question format that you would see very often. I would say, though, that if you were discussing whether those three topics are connected, you'd probably relate to themes rather than being just one theme. So you could compare and contrast topics, picking more than one theme as a way of doing that. Right. I'm running on a bit. So, first of all, what to do with the comments I had you beginning to draft. You can either hand them in now, or you can keep the paper and use it to guide your comments in the online survey, which you'll be getting about 9 days from now, I should think, and which has open-ended questions, so it's up to you whether you choose to, which of those you choose to do. But before you disappear, I would appreciate it if you could answer on paper and hand in three questions that certainly won't be on the EVASYS survey directly, which is really about aspects of the group work. So I would appreciate it. Separate piece of paper, no name.